and open public hearing on House Bill 2406 and a House Bill 2408, and call the gentleman from PERS. Wasting no time.
Chair Canope, members of the committee, my understanding is you've asked us here today to comment on a bill that seeks to do what we would call an accrual termination of the PERS plan. I hope that's the mission that we're, the correct mission. We are sending around a single page of testimony on the topic that represents, that is an extract from a letter that I wrote to Senator Nelson, who asked me this same question probably over a year ago. The letter is quite long, and we've only excerpted the part that discusses how this might fit into how it would work and how it would fit into a desire on the part of the legislature to change pension policy for the state. But briefly put, pension structures have been terminated frequently in the private sector and sometimes in the public sector, but much less often. And in fact, this plan itself was terminated for very technical reasons back in the 1950s and only for a day. And the purpose of the termination at that time was to meet the qualifications to allow public employees in the state of Oregon to enter the Social Security system. If I recall the research that we did correctly, they could not enter Social Security if they were a member of another plan. So the plan was terminated, they were entered into Social Security, and the plan was reinstated the next day. People have said, asked us whether this represents a good guide to whether or not the plan can or should be terminated in current times, and we'd say we don't know, because as far as we know, the courts were never asked to look at that termination, and we don't know how they would have reacted to it. We, in the late 1990s, at the urging of the Internal Revenue Service, who, to the best of my understanding, told us, meaning the state, your plan needs to inform your members how it might be brought to an end and under what circumstances. And so we at that time added the phrase that you see on the back page of the single page of testimony that was added. The legislature added a section to the bill 238, or to the statute 238.600, that said if the public employee's retirement system is terminated or if contributions may no longer be made to the system, each member of the system has a non-forfeitable right to the benefits that the member has accrued as of the date of termination, or as of the date that contributions may no longer be made to the system to the extent that those benefits are funded. In essence, the legislature put in place this notice to members as to how the plan might be brought to an end if the legislature ever found it in their wisdom to do so. What policy objectives might executing that part of the statute serve? I think it's kind of like erasing the blackboard. If you don't like what's on a canvas or on a blackboard and you no longer think it serves your purpose, you can erase it and start afresh. And I think that we're not recommending that you do so. I think it's really a judgment on the legislature's part as to whether or not it would like to craft a different pension policy and program to implement that policy, not only for new hires, as this committee has discussed at some length, and the House has acted already on that topic, but also for all public employees. One of the things I would point out, though, that is different between an accrual termination and a new hire or a new entry termination is that an accrual termination would collapse all of the tiers that will exist in the PERS plan to now exist. More than that, if you count differing treatments of, for example, AEF factors and mortality tables. And three, now that if we move on to a new hire successor system, but would collapse all of those tiers into a single treatment from this point going forward in and that in the sense that all employees would be accruing pension benefits from the day a new system replaced this one at the same rate and under the same terms. You may recall that Leslie Frain, from one of the member unions, I believe it was SEIU, testified that her member organization had been opposed to tiering, but they reluctantly agreed that this is a circumstance where it might be the best of several outcomes that were unpalatable to them. And I loosely paraphrase what she said. Accrual termination would put every employee from this point forward on the same footing, if that is a policy goal that you would have. Whether there were any other benefits would depend on what replaced the current system if it were terminated and people could not accrue new benefits. With respect to the payment of the non-forfeitable right to benefits that the member has accrued, as the statute says, this is an exercise not too dissimilar to what this committee went through when it looked at HB 2004, and it had to decide what benefit, what elements, inputs into a benefit would receive the treatment of the old factors in the old mortality tables. So you have already had a discussion that mirrors very closely the determination of what an accrued benefit might be. So this is not foreign territory to you. I would encourage you, if you want to pursue this, to read the letter that I wrote to Senator Nelson as a whole, because there are detailed acknowledgments of legal uncertainty with respect to the how and when execution of this statutory provision to require people to move to a new plan, including existing employees. But I don't think I have any light to shed on that. I think you've had a number of attorneys who have indicated that opinions probably vary mightily on that. I would point out, however, that Mr. Hartman did come forward in previous testimony to your committee and raised a new issue that we hadn't considered when we wrote this letter, and that was that this provision was put in and affected employees, became effective, I believe, June 23rd, 1999. And he acknowledged that the ability, when he was asked here, of the legislature to terminate the ability of an existing employee to accrue benefits might be different in terms of their contract rights pre-1999 versus post-1999, because the appearance of the provision in the statute, I presume, might constitute some sort of notice to people hired after that point. Whether this is a real legal distinction or an academic one, I can't say. That's obviously for the courts to decide. But again, the issue is for accrual termination is whether or not the legislature wants to, in fact, put all employees the day after accrual into some new pension policy and program to implement that policy going forward, and on that we have no opinion whatsoever. I'm happy to answer questions about the topic in general or details.
Jim, I recall testimony being given earlier at an earlier hearing, I think it was from Eco Northwest, in regards to the, if you were to do a termination, what the cost would be to fund the benefits for the people currently in the system, as well as to give the people the money that's in their account, you know, earned to date. Do you happen to remember or know, or have you guys done that same exercise?
Chair Knope, members of the committee, we have done that very same exercise, which I believe we submitted to the task force that you chaired, but we measured the effects differently. We measured it on in terms of the savings that employers would accrue over the life of the pension system post-accrual termination as a pool of funds that would then be available potentially to fund the successor system. Echo Northwest study that they presented to you actually turned that around and did the same analysis using our same model and said what would be the effect of on employer rates and actually chose a plan, chose plans similar to the ones that were under discussion at this committee to indicate what level of rates employers might face. In both cases, cost savings to employers from accrual termination is very, very substantial, but the net cost savings will depend on how costly the system is that you put in to replace the current one. So we can't say how much will be saved for sure until the legislature tells us what new system of accruing pension benefits will take its place. And then if there are any differences between the cost of this system and the cost of the new one, those will be savings to the state as a whole.
In terms of it administratively, how difficult is termination compared to the other things that we've already asked you to do?
Chair Canote, members of the committee, and it usually quite simple, because if there's going to be a successor system for new hires, enrolling all existing current members is incremental work, but if those existing members of the system are being rolled into the successor plan for new hires as well, it's simply scaling up the number of enrollments and record keeping, but it's not creating a new structure. Where there would be some uncertainty in terms of the workload would be the calculation of the accrued benefit, because there are many ways, and I'm sure if you had other witnesses here, there would be many arguments about exactly what constitutes an accrued benefit, just as you heard in HB 2004's testimony. And so there are complicated ways to determine what the accrued benefit is, and there are simpler ways. This committee chose to do one of the simpler ways, and if it was a mechanism not unlike the earn-to-date approach in HB 2004, it would be incremental work without a doubt for us. But would it be as difficult, for example, as the individualized COLA freeze being applied to members who retired between 2000 and 2004, as is required of us under HB 2003? I believe it would be much less complicated than that. I think the issues for the legislature are, once again, the constitutionality of executing it, two, whether there's a difference between pre-99 and post-99 individuals, and three, what is the expression of the accrued benefit that is guaranteed as a non-forfeitable right under the current plan structure, which is the per statute.
Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Mr. Boyko, when Echo Northwest made their presentation, they had a model which calculated what the remaining liability would be upon a plan termination, and the assumption they used, as I recall, is that the obligations of the existing system could be satisfied as to active members by simply providing two times their current member account, that is, providing the money match quantity in their current account would provide, with no further liability as assumed for that. Have you or anyone that you've worked with on these issues done any analysis of whether that's a sufficient amount to satisfy or meet the accrued benefit obligations?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, this gives me an opportunity, or you a headache, to dip down into the three major things that were different about our previous analysis in Echo Northwest. First, in specific answer to your question, two times is probably not enough. And the reason is that it doesn't account for HB 3349 gross-ups to account for the taxability of benefits. So, in fact, the match is actually something more than a match. When you get down to the to actually funding all the benefit that's required under law, are the differences huge? No, but in answer to your question, two times is not sufficient to fully fund out the benefits that have been accrued, even under Echo Northwest analysis. The second difference was Echo Northwest did not assume that the accounts, once terminated, benefited from a continuing stream of earnings into the accounts continuing to grow their money match potential for increasing the benefit, whereas ours did. Ours was specifically intended to be conservative. But the most important thing is that all of the benefits that that are in the BIF are uncertain, because we can fund up the BIF to 100%. That is the amount that we think, and that's the key word, that we think is sufficient to pay the streams of benefits to current retirees. But that's not a knowable number, because we don't know how long they're going to live, we don't know how many COLAs they're going to earn over that period of time, and we don't know what investment returns are going to be. So that we can make an estimate, and Echo Northwest did an excellent job, in my opinion, of estimating, and it's consistent, what it would take to terminate the system, but there will always be a residual liability representing the uncertainty of paying out the benefits that are actually going to be owed and must be paid in the future. That won't go away and can't be simply written off by sort of injecting some money. And I would say one other thing that we've discovered in our research, if I might inject this. Apparently, our best understanding is the IRS has a checklist that they give to plan sponsors considering terminating a plan. And the checklist has a number of things, but one of the things that's at the purview of the plan sponsor is how this accrued non-forfeitable right to benefit is paid out to the member. One of the discussions with Echo Northwest was the thought that this would just be rolled into some other tax-protected plan, which to the best of our knowledge is one of the things that can be done, that there, if the accrued benefit is their account balance and some match, if that both is the legislature's desire and holds up to judicial scrutiny, it could be rolled out of this tax-qualified plan into another one potentially. But another opportunity is to say it will be paid out when you become eligible for your benefit that you have vested in at some point in time. And that means that if you're 15 years from retirement, you'll get a benefit from this plan, even though it's been terminated, and it will appear at its regularly scheduled time. But the employer also has the opportunity to fashion something in between, apparently. So there's a great deal of flexibility in how an accrual termination takes place in terms of the delivery of the non-forfeitable right to the benefit, with one extreme being you have to pay the benefit that was in the plan at the time that it was due and the amount that it was due, but you could do something sooner if it was the actuarial equivalent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim, can you provide us with that IRS checklist as it relates to termination, if you've got it handy?
I certainly can, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Did you have testimony on the other bill?
This is on bankruptcy of FERS employers?
Yeah, right.
Steve, did we hand out that?
Yeah.
Okay. My colleague, Mr. Delaney, has also handed out a one-page on municipal bankruptcies. I know that the chair and Representative Butler recall that this was a topic that was delved into during the Speaker's Task Force deliberations. And if I could sum up very, very briefly, PERS apparently has a substantial amount of authority to acquire from public employers the sufficient contributions to fund the benefits that have been earned by their employees. We have often said that when asked whether or not the system could go bankrupt, I have often responded, we have almost unlimited ability, from what I can tell, to reach out and to attach the contributions that are needed from local employers to meet their obligations. Not only do we have the powers that are in statute, but we can appeal to the courts to enforce our ability to receive those contributions. And it's also been asked the question, and it's addressed just partially in here by an excerpt from a federal law abstract, what happens if a municipality, a city or a county in Oregon, declares bankruptcy, including its obligations to PERS? Two points on that. One is that municipalities can do so and have done so in the United States. However, a requirement is that the state authorize in statute local government employers to file, to avail themselves of the protections of bankruptcy filings under federal law. And our best understanding is the legislature has never afforded local municipalities or political jurisdictions the right to seek bankruptcy protection under the federal statute. Even if they were to do so, we would pursue the monies that were needed to fund obligations to members both through the bankruptcy proceeding, but also, if necessary, through the veil of the political jurisdiction to whoever benefited from the public services provided by our members. So, in summary, we don't believe, based on the advice that we've gotten, that the legislature has made it possible for Oregon municipalities to file for bankruptcy, but that's something that the legislature in its wisdom could do if it so choose. But I also want to leave you with the impression that we believe we have strong legal authority to reach out and get the contributions that we need to fund the obligations to our members, and we are doing so. In fact, recently the board authorized subpoenas for a defunct employer who left behind about a $400,000 UAL, and so I want to leave the impression that we will pursue whatever we can to, in every means we can, to get those funds.
Can you talk about that employer, what happened to it?
This was a consortium of community colleges that formed an entity that was created as a PERS employer to fund various types of technology research, job creation, and so on. The community colleges decided after some point that it was not worthwhile continuing to pursue it, and so it was dissolved, but it left behind $400,000 plus unfunded actuarial liability. And so we attempted to contact the entity and put them on a payment schedule, of course, and we did not get any response from either the entity because it had been dissolved or its sponsors. So we went directly to the sponsors, and we are getting the employment records now, and I anticipate that one way or another we'll get their contributions that are owed the system so that we can properly fund the benefits for the people who were enrolled as PERS members in that particular consortium.
Do you have an idea or anticipate how you might get those?
Well, we hope voluntarily from the sponsoring entities. We always seek consensual kinds of arrangements. So we haven't really explored beyond that point. But as my earlier testimony stated, we think we have a number of other strong tools that will allow us to get the funds that we think the entities owe the system. And by the way, I don't want to sound overly aggressive in that respect, because all of these local jurisdictions are under tremendous budget pressure, but as a fiduciary we have no other alternative other than to make people fund the benefits that were accrued by their employees, and to do anything otherwise we think would be a breach of our duty.
It seems to me, as you're talking, I'm trying to determine how your power in that regard would differ from the IRS. I mean, you seem to have all the powers to go attach things, get a judgment, and get the money paid back. And it's amazing power.
Well, Chair Canope, I guess I wouldn't compare us quite to the IRS. Maybe I'd like to compare us to a creditor in a very strong position in a bankruptcy.
Yeah, no kidding. Are there any other instances at the moment of public entities that are that you're seeking payment from that are either defunct or have a similar situation?
Chair Canope, yes, we are. There's a much larger one in the neighborhood of $70 to $80 million of UAL that is held by a fire district that still exists, but in shell form only, with just a few physical assets and I think a single employee. Its service obligations have been dispersed to neighboring municipalities. This occurred back in the early 1990s, late 1980s, and has been a subject of litigation, has been a subject of repeated attempts to settle the issue, and we are continuing our efforts, and we are much further down along the road in terms of employing some of the additional tools that we would need to make sure that the parts of the populace, if you will, that benefited from the provision of that fire protection pay the pension costs of the firefighters that provided that service during that period of time. It's a long-running saga, and it's a much larger number. But I will obviously talk about this at some length if you like, but I'd rather not go into the next legal steps that the board might be taking or might consider, because this has come out of litigation because a judge said that it was not ripe yet, but might be after the board acted. So I don't want to front run either our existing board or the new board in terms of what legal strategy they might take.
This would be Multnomah County Fire District number 10.
That's correct.
Chair, questions?
Mr. Boyko, let's just assume for discussion purposes that the PERS organization was unsuccessful at recovering a liability that was owed for unfunded benefits for members from, say, a special district that disappeared and there was no successor, no place to go to at all. Would that defeat the benefit obligations of the members who had worked for that jurisdiction and who were still then drawing benefits from the system, or is that a general obligation of the system?
Chair Canope, representing McPherson, we had a discussion about this as early as this morning. And our philosophy as it's forming as we go through the Fire District 10 was, first we never considered that this obligation wasn't extant and somehow should be exported to parties that were not, in essence, party to the service provided. Our first philosophy was, if there are political jurisdictions or the populace in those jurisdictions that benefited from the service, that we have to look to them and look to them and look to them, and only as a very last resort look to the people in Corvallis or Eugene or someplace else to fund the obligation, so long as we could identify who those people were. Mm-hmm. The second thing is that as you posed the question, the entity has dissolved and we can't, there's no entity to go against, we looked at following the employees to their new home and saying you're responsible, but we concluded that that was not fair to the or not appropriate, because those jurisdictions didn't benefit from the service that gave rise to the pension obligations in the first place. So we are now considering a different version, which says let's approach a court potentially and ask the question, should not the taxpayers that are of this geography, which is defined, the old extant jurisdiction, should they not be responsible for the debts of the jurisdiction that was created and that served them? That gives you a hint of kind of where we're going about this. We don't have the power to go directly and levy charges or send invoices to non-existent jurisdictions or the populace that served them, but a court does, or at least we believe they do. And so, again, we would exhaust that before we would turn to spreading that cost elsewhere in the system. I do recall that in Senate Bill 134 of the last session, the contingency reserve purposes were changed, am I correct, Steve, that allowed contingency reserve funds to be used, among other things, to defend the board and the system in class action suits for potential settlements, but also for bankruptcies of public employers. But again, I think our fiduciary obligation to other employers requires us to first exhaust every opportunity we have to get the benefit funded by the people who benefited from the service in the first place. I'm sorry for the extended answer. But
all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure that I didn't lose that answer in that process of that explanation. So if there wasn't a successor organization that could be attached or tapped by a court, does that mean then that the other employers within the system would be liable somehow, Jim?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, only as a last resort. I think the steps would be, first, if there are any vestiges of the jurisdiction is the first place we go to, because they created the jobs, hired the people. If there's no jurisdiction left, then our next stop are the people that jurisdiction served. If the courts permit us to and empower us or work as or grant us the mechanism to go directly to those people. If that route does not pan out, then the system as a whole is a closed system, and the employers, as you know, in the current PERS system are the funder of last resort. And so the answer is yes, you might eventually get there, and the mechanism that the legislature has told us to use in that effect is the contingency reserve, which I might add doesn't have any money in it at present. But one of the issues comes up, does it have to have money in it in order to ever use it to satisfy such an obligation? But it is my hope that we can, in all of these instances, fashion a funding arrangement that places the funding obligation where the public employee performed the service that benefited the people of that jurisdiction, and not spread it around willy-nilly.
Follow up. Thank you, Chair. Jim, as we consider House Bill 2406, which would authorize municipalities to file for an adjustment of debts under federal law, and I've read some of the write-up relative to what the ordering of those debts might be, I am just a little bit anxious, and so I need to follow in kind of a linear fashion what and need your help when we get near the end of the line as to what happens when a small town in eastern Oregon can't meet its obligations and can't provide for and pay for its specific debts as they become due. Then they file under Chapter 9 to go ahead and work out to adjust their debts, and your present position is that the debt or obligation for an unfunded actuarial liability to the system would be one that wouldn't be subject to any kind of an adjustment. I maybe better not say that, but if all else fails, then, and there is in effect an adjustment, your position is that the other employers within the system then pick it up after it's adjusted. But let me go back through the adjustment process so that I can kind of get closer to the end of the line there. That city then disenfranchises in effect, but the folks who live in that city, and let's say that there's 100 tax accounts in that particular former city, from what I hear you saying, eventually it sounds like you could seek a circuit court judge to have an opinion to go down to the actual property owners within that city and say the city used to provide these various services, water, sewer, fire protection, even perhaps some police protection, and now you no longer have those services, but you do have this unfunded actuarial liability. And your proportionate share on your 100th lot ownership within this former city, and we're only going to the city limits, the former city limits, at that particular point, your particular share of this unfunded actuarial liability might be 1/100th of the liability, and therefore that we, as through the court, through the circuit court, are sending you a bill for that particular amount, which we will transmit then back to the PERS system. Is that more or less the way that would work?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, you have hit the nail right on the head, but I do want to clarify that this process of asking a court to, in essence, require some group of people to fulfill their obligation to the fund, to the trust fund, is something that we've never done before, but it is something that we've considered, as I've said before. Two is that I don't want to get too specific about how a court might do this. Would it be on the basis of property or per capita? I have no idea, because we've never done it, and a court's never told us how the bill, if it would agree to a writ to say these people need to pay it to us, might actually be fashioned. So I don't want to go that far. I do want to say, though, that if you approve municipal bankruptcy as something that an Oregon jurisdiction can do, then you get into terrain that we haven't yet looked at. For example, this debt would then be put into the pool. We'd be put into the pool of creditors just like every other creditor that the now defunct or bankrupt municipality would owe money to. And I do know only enough about bankruptcy law to know that bankruptcy court has a pecking order with things like salaries and the IRS very high on the list. Pensions are pretty high on the list. A lot of other things, like vendors, are tend to be low on the list. But I'm not expert enough to tell you how that list actually operates and where a state pension system like ours would fit in that pecking order. We've not done that research yet. But if you decide to do this, we're going to become expert in it.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Follow-up.
I guess, Jim, knowing just a little bit about... and knowing very little about Chapter 9 of the Bankruptcy Court, but knowing just a little bit about how the courts have applied those high-order priority items, I would find it somewhat unique to have a federal bankruptcy judge come and start to assess the folks within a city for any kinds of liabilities for operations for their city. So, assuming that the Internal Revenue Service and some of these other folks were way high on the list, and I guess there's some probably some bonded indebtedness that would be even higher still, because those folks would, and there's a method whereby that in bonded indebtedness would be paid off. But I don't know where a federal bankruptcy judge would come out and start to assess individuals. So I think maybe the expectation is perhaps a little high. And basically, what you might be looking at is coming back to the other participants, the other plan participants. And I feel comfortable in where I'm coming from there. I just now need to know what it may look like when now I've got 100 plan participants, not to be confused with the 100 landowners in the defunct city, but now I've got 100 plan participants out here. That each own a proportionate share of that defunct cities. Would you send them a bill at that point? Is that what would be anticipated?
We would only do, Chair Canope, Representative Butler, we would only do what a court empowered us to do. In fact, it would be more likely in our research the court that would require the form and the manner of payment, not PERS itself, if we were to successfully get the court to do this. But I want to clarify, if there is a federal bankruptcy, if the legislature permits such things to happen in a municipality files, it means that the jurisdiction is still a live entity. By definition. So that means that until the entity's gone away, all bills will be directed at the entity, and then the bankruptcy plan will determine how the entity satisfies those obligations, including the PERS obligation. It's only if the entity has disappeared, in which case bankruptcy's moot, then there's simply a free-hanging unfunded obligation to the system. So bankruptcy law wouldn't necessarily really apply here. We would be going after the debt that was owed the system independent of bankruptcy, because no bankruptcy filed. I also want to make clear, just in case there's any press in the room, that this process is invisible to the retirees whose benefits are unfunded. And the reason I say that is because the system pays the obligations that it owes retirees. So, for example, Fire District, Multnomah Fire District 10, we have retirees from Fire District, Multnomah Fire District 10, and they are invisible, or this process is invisible to them. We continue to pay their benefits from the trust fund. We owe it to them. What's happening is really totally on the funding side. And so if we were to get more Multnomah 10s, I want to make sure that everybody understands that the people who retire from these jurisdictions, defunct or default or with UAL, matters not to us. We will use trust fund monies to pay the benefits that are owed those retirees.
Question? Representative Richardson.
Chairman, Mr. Boyko, I'd like to follow up with what you just said. Supposing that there were a number of jurisdictions that defaulted that were very huge, and part of the reason they were defaulting was they did not have the ability to pay their unfunded actuarial liability, and you're saying that there would be no effect on those entities, retirees, that the money is still going to be paid for them. And so if that money is paid to them and the these large number of employers are no longer there, who's paying for that?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, ultimately we hope, based on the discussion we just had, that the entities or the people who benefited from those entities' public services will eventually fund those obligations. But since we seem to be in somewhat of a dark mood here looking at bad outcomes, let's assume that there were sufficiently large bankruptcies, and I don't anticipate those, such that it became difficult to pay benefits without endangering the health of the trust fund. Mm-hmm. That's what the original contingency reserve was structured for. In fact, it was its single purpose based in statute up until the time SB 134 was passed. It was to set aside money in the event that there were insufficient funds to pay benefits. So I would hope that this process would come at a time, it would never come, but if it came, it would come at a time when the contingency fund held sufficient reserves to weather us through bankruptcies of that kind of magnitude without having to even remotely consider the cessation or the curtailment of benefit payments.
Follow up. The reason that we're going into this bill is very short, but it specifically deals with bankruptcy. And in the information you provided, it talks about insolvency, and that's one of the requirements generally for a business to go bankrupt. It's my understanding that insolvency doesn't just mean inability to pay your bills, but also you look at the assets of the entity, and I don't see any mention or haven't heard anything about that. If a school district went bankrupt, would it be required that they sell off schools and real estate and all assets, or merely just be unable to make cash payments for a period of time in the future?
Chair Cano, Representative Richardson, let's take two cases. One is this bill doesn't pass. Let's take Fire District 10 as an example. We don't believe that Fire District 10 has remotely $70 or $80 million worth of physical assets. If it did, could we ask a court to attach them? Quite possibly. So that's one possibility. If this bill passes, then a bankruptcy plan approved by a court will typically, as in the case of Enron, for example, if I can bring up an unsavory example, might have a combination of things that the bankruptcy plan envisions: the sale of some assets, the liquidation of some assets to satisfy obligations, but the bankruptcy judge, often assisted by a court master, may decide that the some operating assets have the potential for generating more value to satisfy creditors by being left intact. So I can't say whether or not a judge would order a school district to sell its buildings. It seems that since it's not a profit-making entity, one would have to sort of reconstruct how a bankruptcy judge would look at that. And my knowledge of the few bankruptcies that were done in the Philadelphia area and in New Haven are so sketchy I hesitate to even mention them, but I don't recall that City Hall was put up for sale.
Can you follow up? I'm trying to understand what has taken place in all the conversation. And so I'd like to ask you one other question that would help clarify it for me. And that is, when we look at the PERS system as a whole, is it like a large company that has multiple offices, any one of which, if it fails to perform on its obligations, will be borne by the other offices in the single large organization? Or is this more like a situation where PERS is administering multiple 800 and some separate accounts, any one of which that has a problem, you'll do whatever you need to do, but it's not going to have a direct consequence on the other entities?
Chair Canope, Representative Richardson, you're going to hate this answer, but I think it's yes, yes, and no. In the following sense, there are each employer generates a set of obligations that they need to pay, and therefore obligations that they need to fund. However, by the creation of pools, the legislature has decided that certain aspects that affect those obligations are going to be shared among them, like the risk of disability. By allowing some employers to say single-rated, those look a lot more like standalone offices whose P&L either floats them or sinks them. And we still have about 200 such entities. So we have some of each in our system in terms of shared responsibility. And then overarching all of that is the contingency reserve, which, as I've said in earlier testimony, is kind of the place of last resort, which is funded directly from entire trust fund earnings, and therefore that particular obligation, if you will, that funding requirement would fall on the entire fund and all of its beneficiaries, with the single exception if you single out lump sum payments made by individual employers to satisfy their UAL. You may recall the discussion that we had about that earlier, about that would be an exception to a long historical pattern for reasons that the authors quite aptly put forward. So we have lots of cross connections between our offices. Some of them are quite standalone in many respects, sometimes all respects if they're individually rated. And then all of them are tied together through the contingency reserve, including members, I might add, because members are affected by contingency reserve funding.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the reference to the contingency fund to me would indicate that it's not only going to be there if it's funded. If there is an ultimate liability that would draw on that fund and that fund isn't there, it seems like unless we get a legal position to the contrary, that if that fund's not there, it's still going to go to the people that were contributing to that contingency reserve fund. And the reason I bring it all up, of course, is if we pass this bill and it goes on through, and ultimately some organization that utilizes the provisions of this and goes into bankruptcy, if ultimately the rest of the PERS or some number of other PERS employers are going to be ultimately responsible, then we may not have, I don't really know what we've accomplished. So it's just a concern.
My colleague, if I might add, Mr. Chair, Mr. Delaney, as always, has made sure that his director is on the straight and narrow. And I want to point out that actually there are two contingency reserves, one that is funded solely by employer contributions that can be tapped to prevent or to satisfy obligations of bankrupt or dissolved employers whom we cannot satisfy through any other means by going directly to the source. So I stand corrected by my staff, which is a place I often find myself. It's a comfortable place to be, actually.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Chair. More in the way of comment, when I served on a different pension board, different system, I kind of followed the law, and you get all the pamphlets and recent court decisions, and I can't remember where it was, but there was a city that couldn't meet its public safety obligations, and it declared bankruptcy, in fact, unincorporated, and they said there is no more city, so there is nothing to draw it from, and the court said, well, let me show you this pretend line I have where your real line used to be. Everybody inside that will pay, and then they build it. So the people who lived in that and used those services did have to pay for it, even though the government entity itself, unincorporated, just went away.
Was that in Oregon?
It was not in Oregon. I don't remember where it was, but I was kind of surprised when I read that. I remember.
Chair Canope, Representative Barker, that judge is obviously thinking along the same lines that we are.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bills 2408 and 2406? Seeing no one else wishing to testify, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2408 and 2406. And we're not ready to work session Senate Bill 325A or House Bill 3314. So if there's nothing else to come before the committee today, committee's adjourned.